Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Sometimes it's hard to talk about race.
It's so hard to even talk about. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it, but I am.
That's an audibly confused Chris Matthews trying to explain his feelings about watching Barack Obama deliver the State of the Union. And as David Walrice said on our show yesterday, it could be a sign that people are beginning to think about race in a new way.
And I do think that he's working through it. I don't think this is the first time he's said something like this. I think he's negotiating and working through it. And from a psychological perspective, I think that's healthy. And I think it's healthy that we have this kind of dialogue.
That may be healthy, but perhaps he shouldn't have said this.
You know, I forgot he was black tonight for an hour.
Healthy for race dialogue, unhealthy for Chris Matthews' career. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 29th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Miles O'Brien. John Hockenberry is away today, so welcome back, Miles.
Good morning, Celeste. Good to be here. I like the new music, too.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, our new theme.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. A day after the State of the Union address, President Obama was once again pushing his message of job growth.
The economy is growing again. The worst of the storm has passed. But I think all of you understand the devastation remains.
Today, the president will give the details of one of his new proposals to jumpstart the economy, giving small businesses a $5,000 tax credit for every new employee they hire this year. He'll make that announcement at a House Republican retreat in Baltimore today. That's right, Republican. He's extending the GOP an olive branch.
I want the Republicans off the sidelines. I want them working with us to solve problems facing working families.
Another topic during the president's State of the Union address was lifting the ban on gays in the military. Top military officials will meet Tuesday to look for a solution.
President Obama wasn't the only one making headlines yesterday following his State of the Union address. MSNBC anchor Chris Matthews caused a bit of a stir after he referenced the president's skin color. He said the president is, quote, post-racial by all appearances. You know, I forgot he was black tonight, unquote. Joining us now is Gustavo Arellano of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Good morning, Gustavo. Oh, we lost Gustavo's line right now, but Gustavo is joining us as well to have a deeper conversation about this and whether or not there should be negative repercussions for Chris Matthews. Personally, I think no, but we're going to have a good discussion about it.
It could help his career, too.
It could.
We're talking about him.
That's
Put
right.
it that way.
In London, Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he'll invite Taliban leaders to a tribal assembly to try to persuade them to lay down their weapons and support the government.
We must reach out to all of our countrymen, especially our disenchanted brothers, who are not part of Al-Qaeda or other terrorist networks.
This morning, Taliban leaders say they're considering the offer. In an interview with The Takeaway, General David Petraeus, the head of U.S. Central Command, told us, though the violence in Afghanistan is increasing, there is growing optimism.
There is a sense in Afghanistan. Interestingly, even some polls have showed a sense of hope among the Afghan people and so on that wasn't present before.
The second half of our interview with General Petraeus is coming up in 30 minutes. So we got that phone line back with Gustavo Arellano. Gustavo?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi. Let me ask that question of you. Do you think there should be negative repercussions for Chris Matthews?
No. Well, we pick on poor Chris enough because he always suffers the daily humiliation of appearing on MSNBC, so we should just leave him alone.
Oh, that's Gustavo Arellano at AskAMexican.com. We're going to be talking to you more about this and actually what it means for the broader implications about race in the United States in just a moment. Stay with us, Gustavo. Looking at the markets, futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,120. The S&P opens at 1,084 and the NASDAQ at 2179.
Coming up on the program, we'll talk movies like we do every Friday. Today, it's about giants, as in the giant pool of Best Picture Oscar nominees. What are there? 10, 20, 30?
There's 10. And we have a trivia question for you as we do every Friday, and we're still talking about the State of the Union with you. Because the Grammys are this weekend, here's the question. What is the soundtrack to your State of the Union in music? How do you portray the State of the Music? Union, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Good Good morning. I am Celeste Headlee, and instead of John Hockenberry, who's out today, I'm joined by Miles O'Brien.
It's a pleasure to be here. Good to meet you in person.
Absolutely, as instead of orally alone. But let's talk about Chris Matthews for just a moment. MSNBC anchor Chris Matthews caused a little bit of a stir when he talked about the president's skin color after the State of the Union. And let's let him speak for himself. This is what he had to say in his attempt to say that race was not on his mind.
He is post-racial, by all appearances. I forgot he was black tonight for an hour.
Okay, the second half of that statement is what got him in trouble. But the first part is what I'm interested in. The idea of post-racial, what does that mean? To talk about this, we're joined by Boyce Watkins. He's a professor at Syracuse University and founder of Your Black World Coalition. Good morning, Boyce.
Good morning.
And welcome again, Gustavo Arellano. He writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. Boyce, let's start with you. I should mention first and foremost that you also work sometimes as a contributor for MSNBC. That's the same network that employs Chris Matthews. So what was your reaction when you heard Chris Matthews' comments?
Well, when he said, I almost forgot that he was a black man, as a black man, which I've been for quite a while now, I said to myself, well, what if you had remembered that he was a black man? Would that mean that his speech would have been less effective? Does that mean that that we haven't achieved certain victories in America? Does that mean that the president should be embarrassed? Does that mean that all the non-black people should run for the door? I really didn't understand what to make of Chris's statements. And even though he works with MSNBC like I do, and I knew I'd get in big trouble for talking about him too much, I had to really ask those questions. And I think Chris answered them effectively on some level, but at the same time, this idea of a post-racial America was a little bit problematic to me, as it always has been.
Okay, so Gustavo, you know, a lot of times people say that the discussion over race is hampered by the fact that people don't say what's really on their minds. Gustavo, do you think Chris Matthews should have edited himself?
No, I think people should always say whatever's on their mind. That said, what was on his mind was absolutely ridiculous. And the more I hear it, the more I think about it, the more sillier it is. Almost forgot. What reminded him that President Obama was a black man? Was it the color of his skin? Was it some, you know, the way he talked? As Orrin Hatch said, did he not talk enough like a Negro or whatever? It's such a silly statement. I'm at a loss of words for once.
Well, you know, we are kind of used to Chris Matthews saying at least borderline silly things. But let's take apart his use of the phrase post-racial. I'm interested in that because we're hearing it a lot, and we have been hearing it since Barack Obama became a serious candidate for president. Boyce, you know, I helped to host an event that WNYC held at the Brooklyn Museum in New York for Martin Luther King Day, and there was a large panel of scholars and thinkers talking about race, and I asked the question whether we live in a post-racial society. Here is the response from Professor Eddie Glaude of Princeton.
It's a lazy term.
Yeah.
And I think it's a term that's reflective of a sincere confusion. Something has happened, and we don't quite know how to describe it yet. So part of what I see it as is just simply a typical American effort to wrap their minds around complex matters very quickly with easy tropes.
Boyce, what do you think?
Well, I agree with Professor Glaude. I think that when you talk about a post-racial America, nobody really knows exactly what that looks like. Does a post-racial America mean that we forget that everybody's black, that blackness just sort of melts into this watered-down melting pot of assimilation and it doesn't mean anything anymore? Well, if that's what a post-racial America means, I don't really want to be a part of that. I think that being black is a beautiful thing. My concern is that I want to simply see blackness become respected. I don't want to see Obama or anybody else get elected because they're light-skinned, they don't speak with Negro dialect, as Harry Reid said, or because they are clean-cut and articulate, or the first, you know, as Joe Biden said last year. I don't want to hear people get elected in spite of the fact that they're black. I want it to be okay for someone to be black and for everyone to not simply, run off in fear because a black man is trying to be in a position of power. Because to some extent, I mean, at the end of the day, we are Americans as well. And so, this idea that one election can create an entire post-racial society and immediately erase 400 years of training in terms of treating one group of people as if they are the subordinate in the American family, that's not going to go away with one election, two elections, or 100 elections. We've got to do the hard work to fulfill Dr. King's dream.
Okay, Boyce Watkins, professor at Syracuse University. So Gustavo Arellano, you write the column Ask a Mexican, and clearly when they say post-racial, they must be referring to lots of different races, including Hispanic. Do you think we are post-racial?
Post-racial is one of those words like proactive and zeitgeist that people who aren't smart try to use to make themselves appear to be intellectual. Post-racial is a hollow term. Obviously, as the professor was talking about, there's no way on earth that we could live in a post-racial society given the history of the United States. Not just one group at the bottom of the totem pole. There's a lot of groups at the bottom of the totem poles, and there always will be. And we do have to I think we've actually progressed pretty well as a society given our horrible legacy of racial antagonism to the point where we're at today, but the election of one person or 10 people or nominations of God knows how many ethnic minorities to important positions in the United States, that doesn't mean that everything's now going to be hunky-dory. I don't think it ever will be, just given the human condition that insists that we have to classify people according to certain terms, and then once you're not the same like someone else, there's probably going to be antagonisms there. Although I would say here in this country, compared to others, it's getting more and more benign, those antagonisms.
Okay, that's Gustavo Arellano. He writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Boyce Watkins, somebody wrote on our website, a listener wrote, being African-American, I couldn't care less about what Chris Matthews said, but this seems as if it's a discussion Caucasians have to overcome. Is there a different discussion or level of measure between what is a point of discussion about race for whites as opposed to people with brown skin?
Well, I think that people with brown skin or anybody who's not white, we need to all get together and have that conversation as a family. That's why I created the conversationonrace.com, because I wanted to promote a national conversation on race. When I talk to Reverend Al Sharpton every single week, that's one of the things that we constantly bring up, is that people do not want to talk about race in an honest and open fashion. So you must give Chris Matthews credit for at least being honest. But at the same time, once he's been honest, the question is, what now? Do we just sweep it under the rug, or do we analyze? I say we analyze, and I say we get to the heart of this issue.
Okay, that's Boyce Watkins, professor at Syracuse University and founder of Your Black World Coalition. We also heard from Gustavo Arellano of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. We have a lot of comments from listeners, and I imagine a lot of you have thoughts on this issue. We want to hear them. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got some takeouts on news stories this week. Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke has finally gotten his second term. Considerable delays on that in the Senate. I guess it's not a surprise. No nominee for Fed Chief has ever been rejected by the Senate. But Bernanke did get more no votes than any other Fed Reserve chairman in history. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Was the confirmation ever truly in doubt?
There were times when it was in doubt, because after several really conservative Republicans, Celeste, and then a couple of liberal Democrats and independents started to really hammer on Bernanke the last few weeks, for standing by during the housing crisis, helping cause the credit crisis at the Fed, and then doing not enough to stop it. As more people piled on in this sort of populist environment, it was in question for a little while. Last weekend, the Senate leadership and several senators made sure to come out strongly and make strong statements that they were all going to vote for Bernanke, and that probably staunched the bleeding. Ben Bernanke got absolutely hammered by some senators against him on the floor the last couple of days. And the people who were for him, to be honest, made tepid statements. They didn't say all that much. So he did get confirmed. He got 70 votes under final passage yesterday. But then the question is, is Ben Bernanke damaged? And I asked Senator Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee. He's on the banking committee. Has Ben Bernanke been scathed and damaged by this whole thing? Listen to this.
You know, look, I yes.
I mean, there's no. I mean, you'd have to be a, you know, asleep to not say that both the Fed as an institution and him as a person haven't been damaged in this whole what I would call tawdry process.
Tawdry process, he calls it. Is he talking
tawdry
about his?
Process.
I assume he's talking about the entire banking crisis and not just the confirmation hearings.
No, I think he is. He's talking about the entire banking crisis. He's in talking about mounting federal debt, bailouts for both autos and banks and AIG. That's what he's talking about. Tawdry indeed.
So maybe we can move on now? This is a closed issue?
Yeah, almost a closed issue. You know, the Senate also had to vote yesterday on raising the federal debt ceiling. This is something the federal government has to do. This is the federal government's borrowing authority, okay?
Right.
And they did finally vote to raise it to over $14.2 trillion. That was the final vote. That's our federal debt ceiling now. But in this populist environment, all the concern about mounting debt, you know, the president the other night, Celeste, called for bipartisanship. This got 60 votes, all Democrats, every Republican standing by and letting the Democrats vote for this thing that has to pass. They just hung them out to dry.
Way to start off the right way, huh?
Hung them out to dry.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick.
I'd like to raise my own debt ceiling. You think American Express would go for that?
No. $13 trillion?
No. Sports takeout now. Let's go to the other side of the world, shall we, where the balls spin in the other direction, I believe. Roger Federer has just defeated Joe Wilfried Tsonga in straight sets at the Australian Open semifinal. Here's the call from the last hour.
Still match point. More satisfaction than the jubilation. Yeah. He came in prepared for a fight, and he got instead a nice light. Hour and 28-minute sparring session.
You've got to love tennis on the radio. Sports Illustrated writer John Wertheim is on location with the latest from the Australian Open. John, it sounds like Federer had a relatively easy match today, straight sets. Was that expected?
This was more decisive than Bernanke's second confirmation hearing. No, I think he did not get as much resistance as a lot of us thought he would. He cruised through, and I mean, the good news is we have a very compelling final, but tonight's match will not be replayed as a classic.
All right, let's talk about Murray versus Federer. Andy Murray, that is, of Great Britain. Great Britain had long drought in Grand Slam victories. Who's going to win?
That's a good question. I think Murray has a real chance. He actually has a winning record against Federer. And, you know, it's tough to bet a, you know, you don't want to bet a zero-time Grand Slam champ against a 15-time Grand Slam champ. I mean, I think Federer's the favorite. But Murray's been playing fantastically well. And I think, you know, I think he's got a real shot here.
All right. And quickly, Serena Williams facing Justine Henin in the women's final. What are your thoughts on that one?
Another good one. I like Justine Henin, who's played a lot less tennis than Serena Williams. I think the conditions will make a difference, but Justine Henin's game is so versatile and complete. It's like nothing Serena's faced in a long time. And, you know, it'd be a great story. This is obviously her first major back after this 18-month retirement she had. And, again, we got two great finals. So a lot of sort of strange twists and turns to get here, but we ended up with quite a nice weekend of tennis.
Fun thing to watch over the weekend. John Wertheim with Sports Illustrated. Thank you.
For last take, we're going to go to you, our listeners. We got lots of responses to the conversation on race after Chris Matthews said he forgot the president was black for a moment during the State of the Union. Here's one listener's point about the president.
This is Cindy calling from Detroit. I have yet to hear him say he is black. The media and everyone, hoo-hoo-ha-ha, our black president. Who coined the phrase, if you have a drop of black blood, you're black? Think about it, and think of what he did in history.
It wasn't actually somebody coined the phrase. There were actually laws during the Jim Crow era that said if you have one drop of black blood, you are black.
Here's a post from our website. TheTakeaway.org is the location. I am indifferent about Chris Matthews' statement because I really don't believe that he meant any derogatory meanings behind it. In fact, I believe he was trying to compliment President Obama, but because of the color of Matthews' skin, I feel it puts a certain limitation on things he could say.
That's interesting. Bill writes back, Matthews could have said, I forgot about Obama's race. I believe that's what he meant. It's like saying, sometimes race seems to be an issue for some people, but tonight I didn't even think about it, period. Anyone who wants to turn that remark into anything more is just looking to start a fight, pure and simple. What do you think? Are people looking to start a fight here? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and let us know.
And back to the actual address, we're looking for your reactions.
My name is Miriam Paisner from Boulder, Colorado. I noticed there was no mention whatsoever of the environment, which is collapsing. Ken Salazar is allowing the roundup of wild horses. They're proposed to reopen horse slaughterhouses in 7 states, and Obama's done nothing to stop that. I voted for Obama. I'm not sure I would do it again.
Thanks to all of you who got so involved in our State of the Union coverage. You can still weigh in on that. And because the Grammys are this weekend, we're asking you to combine these two things together. What is the soundtrack for your State of the Union? What song or piece of music expresses the state of our union right now? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the State of Our Union continues with more conversation with the head of U.S. Central Command, General David Petraeus.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, General David Petraeus has a lot to say, and we're going to hear more of his thoughts as that conversation continues in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama will cross into unfriendly territory this morning when he speaks at a House Republican retreat in Baltimore. He's expected to talk to them about changing the tone in Washington.
Even if you disagree with me on some specific issues, all of us should be rooting for each other. All of us should be rooting for America moving forward and solving problems.
The president will also announce his plan to give small businesses a $5,000 tax credit for every new employee that they hire this year. The White House is considering moving the trial of the chief organizer of the September 11th attacks out of Manhattan. The latest dispute was touched off when New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg complained of costs and possible disruptions.
In London, Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he will invite Taliban leaders to a tribal assembly to try to persuade them to lay down their weapons and support the government. Karzai also says the Afghan army and police are preparing to take over from international forces.
We will spare no effort and sacrifice to lead security of our country within the next 5 years all over Afghanistan.
This morning, the Taliban says it is considering Karzai's offer. And Microsoft posted bigger-than-expected earnings last year with net profits of nearly $7 billion. Wow. Let's check the markets. Asian markets were down. European indices were up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,120. S&P 1,084. The NASDAQ at 2179. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The State of the Union.
The State of our Union.
State of the Union.
My fellow Americans, the State of our Union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
We've been talking all week about the State of our Union. The president didn't talk much about foreign policy in his State of the Union address, but my co-host John Hockenberry got to ask General David Petraeus about it in his wide-ranging interview with the head of U.S. Central Command. Part one of this interview aired yesterday. In part two, John asked the general how he would characterize the state of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen, three areas that are so much a focus in the wars on terrorism.
Well, I think probably best to as a general characterization, to describe, in a sense, the state of al-Qaeda and transnational extremist elements in the Central Command area responsibility. And we generally say that they have been diminished over the course of the last year, but without question, clearly have substantial capability and are constantly adapting and trying to find some way to attack us, our partners, and important infrastructure throughout the world. If you look at Iraq, despite the continued periodic attacks such as we saw yesterday and indeed the day before, despite all that, there has been substantial progress since the conduct of the surge. On the other hand, in Afghanistan, of course, you've seen the violence go up, went up by some 60 or so percent last year over 2008. It is remaining elevated over what it was in 2009.
I mean, in both cases, for civilians and for military personnel, worst couple of years.
Yes, without question. In fact, it got worse in terms of violence in 2008 and then in 2009. Now, having said that, there is a sense in Afghanistan. Interestingly, even some polls have showed a sense of hope among the Afghan people and so on that wasn't present before. So there is a sense of anticipation, But we have to recognize this is going to get harder before it gets easier.
That's General David Petraeus, head of U.S. Central Command, speaking to my co-host, John Hockenberry, this week in Washington. John also asked General Petraeus to respond to a comment that Defense Secretary Robert Gates made recently. Gates said al-Qaeda's mission in South Asia is to get India and Pakistan at war. Here's what General Petraeus said.
Well, frankly, those two countries have actually shown considerable restraint. I think that the response, for example, in the wake of the Mumbai attacks that were carried out by Lashkar-e-Taiba was, again, quite restrained, considering what was done and all the issues connected with this. So, first of all, I think that is something that gives us some reassurance. And Secretary Gates, I think, would say that he has reaffirmed that in his most recent of trips. I certainly have heard him talk about it. Having said that, what he has observed is undoubtedly correct, that there are elements out there, not just al-Qaeda, but perhaps as an example, Lashkar-e-Taiba and others, who would like to ignite or stoke the flames of conflict between India and Pakistan, or frankly, you know, anywhere else they can ignite, as they did in Iraq, sectarian violence, in that case between Sunni and Shia. If they could, in northern Iraq, there have been various efforts to target ethnic groups, the Turkmen, for example, Kurds and Arabs. Again, this is a thinking enemy. It's an enemy that adapts, that realizes that, okay, we may not be able to hijack another plane, so now we'll take someone and put non-metallic explosives in a place where they might not be discovered and try to do that. This is an enemy that again, continues to adjust, that does learn from what has happened, that makes much better use of, say, the internet, of cyberspace, an area that we're all going to have to come to grips with, I think, in the years ahead, as to, you know, what's the role of the military in cyberspace? This is another, in a sense, arguably, it's another battlefield, but again,
sure.
But it's also an area of free speech. And so how, again, all of these...
Well, but to clarify, do you think they have the capability to bring these two nuclear nations to war, or just the intent?
No, I don't. I mean, I think, again, what Secretary Gates was getting at is right, which is that they would like to ignite conflict wherever they can. They want to take down different regimes. Remember, they wanted to take down the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the keeper of the two holy mosques. They wanted to take down governments in a host of different places. And that's what they are about in the name of religion, of course, but certainly a very, very extremist interpretation of their religion that is not shared, needless to say, by the vast, vast majority of their co-religionists.
Everyone has to ask you this. Are you planning a political career, since you've maintained such a meticulous impartiality by your own admission, not even voting since 2002, I believe, between the Republicans and the Democrats? Is that the perfect preparation for a political career for David Petraeus?
It's not. No, it's not. And I have no desire, no willingness, no nothing when it comes to any kind of political aspirations. And, you know, I did that back in 2002 in a very it was a pretty private step to take. I have certainly read of some sort of heroes of mine when I was a younger officer that did that, and I don't put myself in their realm at all. But I thought that, you know, as you get more senior, that you ought to try to scrupulously avoid anything that seems to be partisan. Now, that's really hard to do if you become, as I was as the commander in Iraq, the face of a policy that is certainly associated with one administration and to a degree one party.
That was General David Petraeus, the head of U.S. Central Command. He was speaking with my co-host John Hockenberry on Tuesday. The full interview and the transcript is online at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we talk about movies every Friday. And what does the Oscar pearl look like when you have 10 Best Picture nominees? That's a lot of them. We're going to talk about how to navigate through those waters and who might get included now that they've doubled the size of the nominee pool in just a few minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. All this week, we've been talking about the state of our union. President Obama gave us his version on Wednesday night. Today at the Press Club in Washington, our next guest will describe the state of the Indian Union. I want to say good morning to Jefferson Keel. He's the president of the National Congress of American Indians and a member of the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma. Good morning.
Good morning.
So give us the Reader's Digest version. What is the state of the Indian Union?
Well, the state of the Indian Nations is a reflection over the past year of achievement in the Indian Nations, and it'll be a start of the next year. It'll be somewhat of a reflection of what has been accomplished in this past year, and we look toward this coming year as one of achievement, and we want to see examine what's happened in the past year and just reflect on that and give an update on where the state of the Indian Nations truly is in Indian country.
Okay, so among the Indian Nations themselves, is the state of that union strong? Are they united?
Oh, absolutely. The state of the Indian Nations are, we're proud of the growing recognition that we've had, we've been somewhat able to achieve over the past year, that particularly the recognition of the state of the nation-to-nation relationship between the Indian tribes and the United States. So it is strong, and it's growing stronger every day.
But, you know, the state of the Indian Nations and their unity hasn't always reflected this kind of gap between the needs of Indians and the what the U.S. government is willing to provide. Do you feel like that relationship is getting better, improving?
Yes, I do. You know, over the past year, as President Obama noted in his speech the other night, the Recovery Act investments have had a significant impact on not only the country, but Indian country as well. You know, tribal governments received access to some direct funding and the ability to access some important finance tools like economic development and school construction bonds. And that's helped us to restore some of the infrastructure needs that we've had in our tribal communities. And, you know, it's helped to create some jobs and allow our tribal citizens to stay and work in their own communities. And that's very important to us.
Well, you know, they began the census just this week. It began in a Native community in Alaska with the first person they counted was an elderly Inuit man. I'm wondering, is that a big push for you to make sure that the census reaches all areas of the reservation?
Oh, it's absolutely important. We need an accurate count so that the needs of Indian country can be accurately reflected. And, you know, we're often funded on the number of citizens that we have. So it's very important that we get an accurate census count. And so the National Congress of American Indians is working very hard with the Census Bureau in making sure that we get the tools and access to the information out to all of our tribal communities.
Well, I appreciate your coming in. I know you have only a couple hours left before you have to head off to the Press Club in Washington and give your State of the Union address. That is Jefferson Keel, president of the National Congress of American Indians, also a member of the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma. His preview of the state of the Indian Nation. You can respond with your State of the Indian Nation, the Hispanic Nation, or just the Nation Nation with giving us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Today we're asking you to kind of give us your description with using music. If you were going to make a soundtrack for the State of the Union, what would it sound like? Let us know. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is away today, so we are very privileged to have Miles O'Brien filling
nice
in his
to
chair
say.
Today.
Thank
we
you.
Talk about movies every Friday, and we have a trivia question for you today. It has been about 70 years or so since there were 10 nominees in the Best Picture category. That was 1943. Very competitive year for films. What film took home the Best Picture Award in 1943? We're going to have the answer for you and ask our guests in just a moment. But first, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Afghan President Hamid Karzai says reaching out to the Taliban is the best way to end the war in his country. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the U.S. is committed to bringing peace.
The United States military has been authorized to use substantial funds to support the effort, enabling our commanders on the ground to support Afghan government-led initiatives to take insurgents off the battlefield.
In Afghan society, though, there are doubts about how the Taliban would be brought into the fold. This morning in London, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is making his very highly anticipated appearance before a public inquiry into the Iraq War. The BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson joins us now. Rob, good morning.
Good morning.
What kind of questions has Tony Blair been facing this morning?
Well, all the questions that you'd expect. They're still in the early stages, and so far they've focused on why was it that Tony Blair decided to back the United States in its decision to go to war against Iraq, and in particular about his relationship with President Bush and when it was that Britain, at what point it was that Britain had essentially committed its military support to the United States. And it seems from listening to Mr. Blair that it happened quite early on in 2002.
Well, he said in the past that he was convinced by the evidence that there was a real danger there. Has his answer changed since then?
No, not at all. And in fact, the session is just covering that very topic now, this issue of had Britain, had the United States, although of course the focus is on Britain, had Britain in some way sexed up, as the allegation was, the intelligence on Iraq. And essentially what Mr. Blair is saying is that he believed beyond doubt that Iraq did have weapons of mass destruction. And he's just been saying, you know, of course, the way these things are judged is what happens. What makes a difference is what happens afterwards. And he was just saying, look at what happened with the 9/11 Commission in the United States. Look what happened after the 7/7 London transport bombings in London, where everyone was saying, well, hang on, you had bits of intelligence, why didn't you act?
Okay, Rob Watson, thanks so much. He's the BBC correspondent, joined us from London.
In Haiti, the United Nations held a memorial service in the capital to remember workers killed in the quake. Meanwhile, the UN World Food Program will add 3 food distribution points today. Back at home, top military advisors will hold a meeting about the plan to allow gays to serve openly in the military. The meeting is scheduled for Tuesday. Meanwhile, President Obama is calling on Congress to pass a new law extending benefits to same-sex partners. NASA may soon get a $6 billion boost, but the money comes over 5 years, and it isn't enough to get the space agency back to the moon. Keith Cowing is the editor at NASAWatch.com. He says the budget proposal isn't going to please everyone.
NASA's getting more money at a time when discretionary spending is going to be frozen, so I guess you would say that's good. However, in the longer run of how where NASA is, where it needed to be, where it should be, I'm not necessarily certain it's good.
No bucks, no Buck Rogers, they say. Much of the new cash would go to commercial companies to provide transportation to the International Space Station. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see.
We talk about movies on The Takeaway on Fridays, and today's topic is the huge pool of Best Picture Oscar nominees. On Tuesday, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences will announce this year's nominations, and for the first time in 70 years or so, there will be 10 nominees for Best Picture instead of 5. Rafer Guzman is the film critic for the New York Newsday, and A.O. Scott is film critic for the New York Times. Good morning to both of you. A.O., why? Why double the size of the nominations?
Well, in recent years, the ratings for the broadcast have been, you know, sort of steadily eroding, and there's a sense, and it's very important that that Oscar night broadcast and bringing in a bigger audience. And one of the reasons that it's speculated, at least, is that the movies that have been nominated have been some of the less widely commercial, mass-marketed blockbuster movies. That it's been sort of smaller movies. A couple years ago, you had No Country for Old Men, for example, in a race against There Will Be Blood. Both of the companies that released those movies no longer exist, partly because of the expense of marketing movies like that for Oscars. And then last year, there was a great hue and cry when The Dark Knight didn't get a Best Picture nomination. So I think some of the thinking was if they can bring in more of the popular movies that audiences really liked during the year, at least fold them into this field of 10, then that will bring some of the audiences who like those movies to the show.
Well, it seems odd because we know movies like Avatar and Up in the Air are going to get a nod in the nominations. But, you know, Rafer, I'm wondering, maybe this doubling the size of the nominee pool will allow us to get things like this in there.
Drop the phone!
Hey, bro!
I can't get a shot!
That's the Hurt Locker. That's most likely going to get a Best Picture nomination.
I think that's
going on. Maybe there's going to be room for this one.
You remember our friend Doug?
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine. I wish I had a light-skinned boyfriend with real nice hair. But first, I want to be in one of them BET videos.
Could it be that perhaps doubling the size of the nominees maybe will get us movies like Dark Knight in there, but also some of these other movies?
I think it will. I think you'll get I think that's Precious that we just heard the
clip Precious.
From. I think that will definitely be in there. I think there's some talk that a movie like Serious Man might go in there, a movie like An Education, which was also a small, you know, limited release film. I think that'll go in. I think what the president of the Academy had said when he made the announcement was that there might be a chance that you'll see things like comedies, which often go overlooked. You get things like that in there. That's why I think people were very surprised when The Hangover won the Golden Globe for Best Comedy. So now I think there's this question. Seems a little unlikely, but there's this question: are we going to have The Hangover rubbing shoulders with The Hurt Locker?
I bet we could take some good odds on that. But AO, what nominations do you think might surprise us this year?
Well, I think there are some I think what's funny about the 10 picture race is it's still going to come down to probably, you know, two or three that are really in contention, probably Avatar, The Hurt Locker and Up in the Air that have been in the sort of preliminary awards, you know, doing very well. And I don't think when they were planning this, the Academy knew that the Avatar phenomenon was coming down the pike. I think the Hangover is a possible sort of surprise, because sometimes comedies get nominated. Very rarely does this kind of, you know, raunchy, vulgar, R-rated sex comedy get nominated. I think, you know, another possible surprise would be District 9, which was a sort of a hit last summer, kind of, you know, science fiction allegory plot, rather similar, oddly, to Avatar. Maybe some of the smaller ones that Rafer mentioned. I think that there will be more emphasis, though, on popularity and on movies that made money. I think another one that could sneak in addition to the Best Actress nominee it's sure to get is The Blind Side, starring Sandra Bullock.
Big Mike, why were you going to the gym?
Because it's warm.
Do you have any place to stay tonight? Don't you dare lie to me.
Okay, and Rafer, who might get snubbed?
Who might get snubbed? You know, that's a good question. I think Crazy Heart might get snubbed for a Best Picture nomination. I think Jeff Bridges is clearly in the running, possibly the front runner for the Best Actor. I don't know if I've heard a lot of buzz in terms of Crazy Heart getting the Best Picture nomination.
Okay, well, let's go to our trivia question. It has been about 70 years or so since we had 10 nominees for Best Picture, 1943. What film took home the top honors of the year? Tony Scott?
I'm going to just embarrass myself and lose all my credibility. I don't know. Mrs. Miniver was the year before, I think.
Rafer, any ideas?
I do know. It's Casablanca.
Casablanca.
No. He's looking at you, kid.
So that's kind of the iconic Best Picture winner,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, if the Academy always had that good judgment, you know, things would be
wouldn't
very,
that be
very
great?
Different.
Rafer Guzman, Takeaway movie contributor, film critic for Newsday, and thanks to A.O. Scott, film critic for The New York Times. And always, we've been asking about the State of the Union. Speaking of movies and soundtracks and iconic songs, we're asking you to give us your State of the Union soundtrack. Is there a song that best describes the state of our union? Rafer?
I would say Ball of Confusion.
Give us your song suggestion at 8778-MY-TAKE. Any suggestions, Tony Scott?
I would say Career Opportunities by The Clash, the ones that never knock.
Interesting.
Even better.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Miles O'Brien, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.